live show.
Blog Talk Radio.
Radio Network. Once again, it is that time, 8 to 9 p.m. on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Time for the Kate Thompson Live Show. I am commonly known as the son, Eric Payne, and you are the one and only. Here she is.
You're so fun. Anyway, Kate Thompson here. Everyone, with my son, Eric Payne, and we are going to be having a good time tonight. As a matter of fact, you know, the Newark International Film Festival, you know, on the 30th of March, right?
Right.
Was held at the Haynes Building, downtown Newark. Let me tell you something. If you haven't been in downtown Newark in a long time, you are going to be absolutely amazed. This is one of the most fabulous buildings. It is diagonally across from or around the area of the New Jersey Performing Arts Center. So this is where the Newark International Film Festival, a presentation. It was hugely successful. And Eric, you were the, the host, right? Right. And then you interviewed and talked to Richard Wesley, a filmmaker, you know, writer, author, et cetera, so many different films.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
So what I want you to do before Wayne and Byron, you know, check in, I want you to tell us about the film festival, or you can start with, you know, your background, because your background is absolutely fantastic, and I'm quite proud of it.
Okay. Yeah. Your mom is thinking I'm not letting people know what I do.
Right.
A lot of people that are probably listening probably know me from the work I've done or friends of mine that know that I'm an actor and all that. Anyway, so it was a discussion with the Newark International Film Festival has leading up to the actual the Newark International Film Festival. Leading up to the actual festival, there'll be a series of year-long events that the Newark International Film Festival is sponsoring. And this was the first in the year. It was an interview with Richard Wesley, who, as my mother said, is a screenwriter, a playwright, award-winning playwriter, a screenwriter of the probably best-known work that he's done are the classic African-American comedies, Uptown Saturday Night and Let's Do It Again, starring Sidney Poitier and Bill Cosby and Harry Belafonte was in one of them, Richard Pryor in one of them, Flip Wilson. They all star black cast in about the mid-70s starred in these films. So these were hugely popular and successful films. And Richard Wesley is a resident, born and raised in Newark, New Jersey, my homeboy, and he is someone that's, like I said, widely accomplished. And it was a pleasure to sit down and get a chance to talk to him. I see him often in the area. And I talk to him, talk his ear off, I'm sure. I try to talk to him a lot whenever I see him, just because I'm really interested, obviously, in someone who's achieved a certain level of success, or people's stories that other artists and people who work in the business. I'm always interested in their journey as an artist. So we had the discussion last Thursday, I believe it was. Yes, last Thursday.
Yeah.
Down at the newly renovated Haynes Building,
mm-hmm.
downtown Newark, which is also now a residence, and they have halls and things you can have events. They have a big state-of-the-art Whole Foods supermarket down there, so this is part of the rejuvenation of downtown Newark. So it turned out pretty good, and we had a good time. It was a good discussion with Richard Wesley. And people seem to enjoy and engage our discussion. Those people that are interested in the film industry and as professionals or as lay people as well.
Yeah, that was really, really exciting. You know, one thing, and also a lot of the people who came in, you know, to hear the conversation, you know, and to get the information about movie making, and I'm assuming that a lot of them were potential you know, people who want to be film makers and filmmakers. Is
right.
that right?
Right.
And you got some very interesting conversations, you know, because they had, you know, they were making interesting points and they wanted to be in the business. And I think they could have paid for this, because this was free admission.
Right, right. It's, well, you know, anytime you get an opportunity to speak to people. Let's bring up one of our our guest resident, Byron Saunders, who is also there, who is also a thespian as well. Byron is an actor who's acted in some plays, and I think, believe he said he has worked with Richard Wesley before, or at least performed some of his works. So let's bring Byron in on this discussion. Byron Saunders. Hey, Byron, how you doing?
It's another blessed day in paradise. Trying to enjoy some spring weather up here, you know, in New York. But that presentation by Richard Wesley was absolutely wonderful. Congratulations to you. You're a good host, I'm telling you. You worked that project and that program that night. I mean, you need a television show, okay, Eric? Okay.
I had a good teacher.
Yeah. And Richard and I have known each other for quite some time because I've run 5 different theater companies, and one of the productions, Mighty Gents, that I produced at Just Us Theater in Atlanta, Georgia, back in the 1980s. And so Richard and I have kind of been circling each other. And when I introduced myself, he says, Byron, whoa, my gosh, we got to connect. Because he's writing a new book on black theaters from across the country from the last 30, 40 years. And he wants to engage what I did with respect to running one of the top black professional theater companies in the country and the work that he has done as a writer. You know, I mean, Pearl Clegg was my playwright in residence, and I directed all of her original shows. So it's one of those moments where colleagues and peers get together and have a chance to really touch base with each other. And I'm so glad that Kay and you had invited me to come to that. And so thank you. It was special, very, very special.
Yeah, you know, I got to, you know, people talk about, you know, the interview and things like that, you know. Obviously, you know, if people haven't been paying attention to over the last 20, 25 years, I learned the interview process and how to do that from my mom, who, you know, obviously the host of her show on WLIB at NFC Broadcasting for some, 20 years, I guess, to say the least.
Right.
So, you know, listening to that and being able to be in there and also growing up in the type of family that was encouraged by our parents to engage in discussions and things like that. So, you know, we are used to talking about, I'm certainly used to talking about my craft and things like that. And like you said, it's always nice to get around other artists and chop it up and talk shop and talk about the industry and just the craft of theater and things like that. It's really, like I said, about the journey, and there's so much in common. And I think that the average, everyday, the rank-and-file people in the industry don't get the respect. Rank-and-file people who work, actors, writers, designers. You know, this makes up the community of the industry, of the arts. So
yes.
A lot of people, and certainly what I like to make sure is that a lot of African-American people who have done things of note that I know, like you do, throughout the course of history, you know, when they talk about certain actors and actresses and people like that, if I know, I like to, you know, give people a point of clarification and a frame of reference when these names come up so people really understand, you know, the historical reference. Like, you know, Richard Wesley talks about his development as a writer was greatly affected by the time in which he was born into, the time of history
right.
of the world, the United States, with which he was a citizen. And so being born in that turbulent time of the late 60s, I mean, coming of age in that time of the late 60s, civil rights movement, the 70s, Black Panther, and the Black Power movement, you know, that affected his art. He says in his in the book, I was born at the right time and the right place. It was a very fertile ground for a writer and things for a writer and artist to be influenced by. As you know, Byron, we're influenced by our world and our environment, the true artist, right?
Absolutely, and definitely. What I really appreciated was listening to him identify and clarify the periods that he went through as a writer, in which, like, of course, August Wilson creating a decades of his work, but with respect
right.
to with respect to Richard's work, he created work based on his own age and where he was at that moment, and taking us through those moments where there was Afrocentric periods,
right,
where there was, when he got to the 30s and the 40s, his political persuasion and social recognition changed, and his work reflected that. That's wonderful. I mean, that, like you just said, that's like attending a master class.
Yeah, it really is. And to see these writers who capture these portions of Black Americana, because if you look at Uptown Saturday Night, or Let's Do It Again, that is Black Americana, from the go-to-church on Sunday people to the hustlers and the people that hang out on Saturday nights. And to,
right,
everything, to the people being involved in the arts and in the cultural things, in the dance classes, dance studios, you know, with the African drum dance studio, certainly reminds me of growing up when my mom had the dance studio, and they would have the African drummers come in there for class and do that. So that was really a slice at that time. As we step back and look at it from this point, all these years later, that was really a classic, a slice of Black Americana that he captured in culture. That really is, for me, why I enjoy so much watching movies of that era, particular movies that are done so well and have captured it so nicely. I think is really why I love to watch them every time I get a chance. I actually own copies of them, to be full disclosure, everybody.
Well, you know, the nice thing is also, go ahead, Kay.
Yeah, excuse me. Which movies do you prefer, not prefer, but really, really took to heart? Is there any specific one that you loved more than any other? Was it what?
Yeah, that's what I was just saying.
The
ones, Let's Do It Again and Uptown Saturday Night, are two of my favorite movies.
Mm-hmm.
And they're written by him, and, you know, they starred the all-star Black cast of the day. Not only Richard Pryor, not only Bill Cosby and Sidney Poitier, but you had Harry Belafonte, Calvin Lockhart, Richard Pryor, Flip Wilson, Rosalind Cash, Paula Kelly, Roscoe Lee Brown, Ozzie Davis. I mean, these were really great. Jimmy Walker, John Amos, you know, really great classic Black movies. That's why they were so classic of the day, because it had all of Black America's movie stars, his favorite stars in these movies, doing cameos, doing whatever they could. It was really great. Even the character actors that you would see, you know, Byron, in a lot of movies and stuff like that, you don't really know their names. Their names aren't on the tip of everybody's tongue. Like Julius Carey. You know, a lot of people know Julius Carey. That's the bald gentleman that always had the Isaac Hayes vibe. He was rocking the baldy back in the 70s with Isaac. He was the only Black actor, you know, back then. You know, the bald head brother, you know, he was badass, you know. He was like, the bad guy. Kind of like in Cooley High, which is another one of those classic 70s Black movies that's a come-of-age story in Black America, but it's one of my favorite ones. You were going to say before, Byron?
I was just going to comment that, thank you, Kay, for asking that, because during that time period, I served on the Georgia Film Commission for 7 years, and some of those movies shot at Big Bethel in Atlanta, going from there to New Orleans. You know, it's like a moment of which ultimately here I am being a part of the industry as a film commissioner, as a producer of theater. And then once I come to New York to run the Frank Silvera Writers Workshop, once again, reconnecting with those same talents, coming to the workshop with Ozzie and Ruby, and that, you know how it was at every Monday, there was a reading. And so here I am, engaged in the business, in the industry, working with the same people that you see on the screen, you know, you've worked with personally, you got to know personally. And then, of course, that for me, meeting Richard Wesley personally, finally, after all these years of recognizing each other, was like a moment of triumph and validation for all that we have done. And like you said, you got a great teacher in your mom in the interview process. And guess what? My first show working with where I got the chance to do the history and then have my own show was working with Kay Thompson. So I, too,
right.
have been mentored and brought forward by the very great, iconic, and as I call her, the Grand Dame of Radio in New York City, Kay Thompson
right.
Live. There you go.
Right. Right, yeah. I mean, you know, it's really interesting to point out some of the influences. You know, like Richard was saying, he was influenced by Ozzy Davis and Ruby Dee, and
yeah.
as I was, I mean, you know, they did the Black college circuit, you know, and she came, I remember they came to Hampton to do a presentation, and, you know, I was affected by their performance, by what they shared during that time. And then fast forward these many years later, lo and behold, here I am working with both of these great actors. Miss D, Miss Ruby, I worked
mm-hmm.
during the course of my career upon getting my SAG card. One of the jobs I did that enabled me to get my SAG card, you know, was one of the soap operas that shot back in the day in New York City, a soap opera called One Life
yes.
to Live. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, you back in those days, you know, you could, I joined the AFTRA initially first. That was the first base union that I got in. It was easier to get in that union. And then after that, I was eligible to join SAG. But to join SAG, you needed to have
yes.
more than five lines or something. And this particular
exactly.
job that I was cast in on the soap opera, One Life to Live, was a job playing a bailiff in one of the many trials that they have on the soap operas. And lo and behold, Miss
mm-hmm.
Ruby Dee was the judge. And so I got to for a week to work on this soap opera, One Life to Live, playing the bailiff to Ruby Dee's judge. But the real treat came when Miss Dee asked me if I would help her run her lines. And, you know,
wow.
I couldn't be more honored to be able to do some work with this legendary black artist and also an activist as well. And
yes,
then
yes.
fast forward even years later to get a chance to work with Mr. Ozzy on the movie School Days.
Yes.
You know, hearing his booming voice. So it was really a joy to think come full circle. Even further than that, another tidbit of information, their son, Guy Davis, who starred
yes,
in
Guy.
The classic hip-hop film Beat Street, was
yes.
at one point going to possibly try to join the cast of a play I did called Jonan years ago. That was
yeah, I know. I remember Jonan. Sure.
And Guy Davis did a reading, a stage reading, or a read, just a reading, not a staged reading, of the script that we did at one point. It was looking like he might join the cast, but it never worked out. So my relations and connections to some of the names of Ruby Dee are kind of numerous, but also it's also a joy in the industry. To me, it was always a measure, a marker, whether I could make it in the industry. You know, the first
yeah.
thing was to know that someone like Amiri Baraka was from my hometown. And, you know,
yeah.
my dad told me that and arranged for me to be able to interview him for my senior thesis project in college. It was a great opportunity. He was a man that I studied. You know, the answer on tests that I've taken. And this man was from the same town, from the hometown that I was. So, and then getting out of college and working and meeting Joe Papp and getting recruited or recognized in the play that I was doing by the New York Shakespeare Company and Joe Papp and his staff. And, you know, when they pick up a show in that scenario, you know, when you go from off-Broadway to off-Broadway, a producer like Joe Papp comes along somewhere like, at that level, of course they decide who they want to bring with the show, if there's anybody, or they might just take the show itself and totally recast. Well, in this particular scenario, I had the second lead in this play called Jonan, another storyline about black colleges. But
mm-hmm.
when they came to decide to pick up the show and take it to the New York Shakespeare Festival, the Public Theater, they said we definitely want to keep so-and-so, so-and-so. Unfortunately, my name was one of the names that they decided to keep with the show. And you know, mm-hmm. that was another indicator that, yeah, maybe I do have what it takes to work in this industry. You know? So you look for those markers along your career, you know, when you work with established people. I mean, I said it to say, you know,
yeah.
when I ended up working with Ozzy Davis and Ruby Dee, it was kind of a validation for me that, yeah, I'm on the right path a little bit, you know, working with the greats, with the established
yes.
people in our industry. So
you know, each step of the way, and then meeting Spike Lee and working with him and other actors, each step of the way, you know, you kind of get those markers and say, okay, you kind of do have what it takes, you know.
Yes.
And
you know, Eric, the validation that's also critical for those who are listening to us is to really understand and comprehend and appreciate our history. My goodness, look at what history you just rolled out. And you know how many connections along the way you and I have known each other but never met until most recently? I mean, my connection is with Hampton. I went to Hampton, class of 73. I worked with Bill Lee. I knew Spike when he was a little boy and Schwa. And, you know, all these people, and here it is, 10 degrees or 6 degrees of separation. I always say it's only 10 people in the entire world. 9 of us know each other. And everybody else of those who know each other are trying to figure out, don't we know that person right there? Of course we know that person. But it's our history that binds us and brings us together, that we must recognize the heroes, the sheroes, the ancestors who have given to us and paved the path for us to be on this road to freedom and to freedom land.
Yeah. You know, Wayne Gilman is on his way in, not on his way in, but on his way to his house because he was running a little bit late. But he called to let me know that he will be on. You know, the thing that the people that you were mentioning, Eric, if you remember correctly, you know, Ruby Dee and Esther Roll, of course. When I said you remember, I interviewed, Ruby Dee, Esther Roll, you know.
I was going to say, when you bring
Esther,
up
Johnny, yes.
John Amos, you bring up Mom. My mother brings up Esther Roll, but, you know, Esther Roll came to Newark and worked at the Theater of Universal Images and did a production, I think, of Listen. She came to Newark and worked at the Theater of Universal Images and did a production of a play.
Okay.
And then let me do it with you right there. What I'm saying is
watch your mouth.
So anyway, so Miss Rowe, she came in, and I think during the course of time you might have interviewed her or whatever, but I remember you and her became kind of friendly. You and Esther Rowe, right?
Yeah. I didn't get a chance to interview. Well, I did in the car because I gave her a ride from, I think, the hotel to someplace. And I also, you know, gave her a bracelet that I was wearing. So that was my contact with Esther Rowe. Unfortunately, I didn't get to interview her. But I did get to interview her partner at the time before. I forget the name of the play that they were doing, the, you know, sitcom. John Amos, you know. A lot of people, Spike Lee, Manjwali, of course, you know. Other people. So because of you being involved in acting, you know, starting in Hampton.
Right.
Or before that, really.
I had Esther Rowe in I produced her in a show in Atlanta at Just Us Theater, Sty of the Blind Pig, by Philip Hayes Dean, the same Philip Hayes Dean who wrote Robeson, okay, for Broadway. And I remember Esther was such great people. I mean, we had our cast party with her. We had a fish fry, and she got down and homie on us, okay? So it's like her roots are from Florida, and this is why that history, guys, is so critical to us. Cannot say it enough, because we have a chance with Kay Thompson Live to talk about, the current issues and how they reflect and ultimately have impact on our lives today, but it's because we have great remembrances and how we connect the history to what is going on right now. And that's what one of the things that Richard Wesley made very clear to the young filmmakers there. And, you know, as he answered their questions, telling them, write, talk about what's going on right now. It may not be the next great African-American theatrical classic, but if you're going to write these stories, and this is something that Hosea Williams, one of Martin Luther King's 12 associates, said to me and Liz O'Malami, his daughter, as we were doing People Survival Theater associated with SCLC in Atlanta, and one day he said, Byron and Liz, I don't know why y'all continue to do theater that ain't got nothing to do with nothing. He said, you just take one story, just one story from the civil rights movement, and I guarantee you, you'll have a hit for the rest of your life. Now, that was back in 1975, Eric and Kay. And you look at the stories that have made an impact in movies and film and theater, even with Richard Wesley and all the way up to today, Hidden Figures, 12 Years a Slave, Fences, all of these stories are reflective of that moment in that period. And he was right.
Exactly.
We don't have to do, you know what I'm saying, Eric?
Let me get Wayne in here, too. We're being joined now by our legendary newsman, Mr. Wayne Gilman. Wayne, how are you this evening?
Hey, good evening, folks. And forgive my tardiness. You could I could just blame the people, the fine folks at the Neurochel Home Depot. What can I say? You know. But life goes on, you know. But speaking of Richard Wesley, we had an enjoyable time last week, met a lot of interesting people, Eric. You did an excellent job. It could have gone on another 5 hours.
Yeah, really.
Yeah, people really were enjoying that. Because
yeah,
like
really. I mean, I learned a lot. I mean, there's a lot. I didn't realize how much of a vacuum with respect to entertainment and history that I was in until I heard some of the things that he was saying, you know?
Yeah.
You got to do it again,
you know,
soon.
People are often interested. I mean, the purpose of that was an industry event for people that are interested in media and filmmaking. So, you know, there's never really enough information, and especially people are always interested in what people that have a certain level of success or what they achieve as a success or achieve a certain level of recognition in the industry, because it's on top of it being a there's a certain amount of chance in it, you know. People expect have to recognize what they expect out of this industry when they decide to get into it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens, I don't know if you're doing a lot of moving around there. We can hear you. Are you moving stuff there, Brother Gilman? It sounds like you're working.
No, I'm quiet as a mouse here. I'm just listening
okay.
attentively.
Maybe
there's an open mic somewhere.
Yeah, part of the thing is that people never get an opportunity to talk to people who they think that they have made it. And I think that there's such a element of chance in what people deem as achieving a certain level of success in the arts, or particularly in, you know, movies and TV and plays. They don't understand, you know, Byron, that you know, the level of success is that you work consistently throughout your career as an
artist. Absolutely.
And if you're able to support yourself financially, that's a level of success, right? If you're able to make your love your job and support yourself off of it, that's a level of success. And a lot of people don't realize that as an artist, to be able to work consistently, to have a job consistently over a number of years, that's a level of success. It's not a matter of, people see the movie stars and TV stars, and they think that's the extreme level of it, and they shoot for that. And a lot of times people get disappointed when they start their life trying to be an actor or a writer or a producer or a director, because there is no set path that you can take that's automatically going to equate in you achieving that level of success that you think you should have. So you have to be prepared, like in life, you know, the bumps that may come from it.
And I tell you one thing, not to cut you off, Eric. I mean, just spending the 2 hours there, I realize how challenging and how difficult, you know, both you and Byron have done this for a living. And, I know in entertainment to a certain extent, even with what you're doing with news, what we've done with news and TV, you know, you get used to rejection. You have to have a callous skin. But, you know, there's such great subjectivity with regard to separating the wheat from the chaff. I mean, it's like you don't know who in the mix will have a sustaining career doing what they're doing and enjoying it. But I guess the key is, you know, regardless of what level of success you may achieve, it's just to maintain just to be resolute to continue to doing what you're doing to become successful, you know, because I guess there's more rejection, this is what I'm trying to say, than what, you know, you would find in terms of success when you start out, you know, I would imagine.
But when, you know, one thing, we go back a long way, you know, at WLIBBLS, and I want to tell, let people know that you are the director of the news department over at WLIBBLS for a long period of time. And when I met you, when I was allowed to come on the air. And also,
tell you, Kay, I mean, even that, I mean, and not to say that I dwell on that, but it seems like so long ago, and so much of the industry has changed. And just as an aside, tonight there's a guy I used to work with for almost 40, well, off and on 40 years. I started out with him at 1010 Wins as a writer. And he is now running. He is now a she. His name is. He was formerly known as David Browdy. And I was just surprised today. I had lost contact with him, and I thought he had dropped out of the business, to be honest. And he's running for a supervisory position somewhere, an elected seat up in Chappaqua, New York. And I'm just amazed, you know, at how suddenly this whole transgender phenomenon has gained such great acceptance, and I never knew this about him. You know, I mean, it was just I'm sitting there watching the TV, and I knew this person is David, and all of a sudden he's Christine, and I know this is like really off topic, but I'm just saying, you know, I'm still like taken back by what's going on, and thank God for people like Barack Obama that. He's given a certain amount of credibility, and you know, the things that this man has done that the current president is undoing day by day is just unfathomable.
Yeah, but you know, Wayne, we're not going to be talking about politics for a while. I want to stay with the arts, okay, for another minute.
Sure.
Sonny Sutherland, okay, talk to Sonny today. And you know how important Sonny was, you know, over there at WLIBBLS. As a matter of fact, that's my sort of like my big brother. I was talking to him today, so he's going to be coming on board. And I can't wait because we have a lot to talk about. And so many things. But let's get back to the event.
Well, I mean that was nice. I also want to talk about you know, currently today, the president's new kind of accusation against Susan Rice. Now, blame her. You know, it's just really remarkable that we have. It's not remarkable. I guess we should stop saying that by now. I'm just waiting for everybody to realize that this man should not be president. But not only that. That, you know, taking responsibility for nothing but credit, try to take credit for everything. And
exactly.
Really, I guess that's indicative of America, because to literally, we live in a country that people made it all right to make people slaves. They accepted that, and they made that notion, that concept, that other human beings should be slaves. So to expect certain people to have a certain basic sense of morality and humanity is really, I believe, I'm coming to believe that it's out of the question, because there's people that still support this man, and they're changing, for them to change the argument from people being picked up on by surveillance of doing, potentially doing bad things, right? You're not going to be seen, if somebody's surveilling the bad guys and somebody you know that you hang out with comes into the picture while the good guys are surveilling the bad guys, then that means the person that's your friend might be up to no good, right? He might be hanging out with the bad guys because he might be doing what the bad guys are doing. So the fact that your friend happened to accidentally be picked up hanging out with the bad guys while people were following the bad guys to see if they do bad guy stuff, and one of your boys happens to walk in the picture, then, oh, well, he must be a bad guy too. But to change up, you know, I mean, the whole argument is crazy what these people try to put down. And the fact that the masses of people who support this guy are willing to believe it because it supports their cause, you know. Like they're trying to reverse engineer the story about why Trump said that about Obama wiretapping his phones. You know, that's what they're saying, why he had Devin Nunes come over there and had him come to the White House the night before
and they gave him the information. So they're trying to create the evidence to support Trump's lie. Uh-huh. And the whole thing is just so unbelievable. So it, a lot of people are accepting that, but it's more than that, they're accepting it. These people that follow him blindly, they actually believe in a certain set of values. They believe in a set of values that says we think that minorities are a substandard of humans. They believe in that. They believe that they should, certain of them, these ones who believe in the stuff, believe that white people are supreme over other races, right? Clearly,
exactly.
They believe that. Because this is what they perpetuate, this is what they repeat time and time again. If you look at the last two Republican presidents, right, they're pretty much incompetent white males, right? And so you had W get elected after someone like Bill Clinton, who's a brilliant guy, morally flawed, obviously, as many human beings are, but left the country with a surplus, right? So W
right.
gets in under questionable circumstances, screws everything up, drives the country into the ground, right? And so really destroys it for the next Republican guy to get in, right? Then all of a sudden Obama comes in, puts the country on track. We go through the whole racial aspect of the first black president, of all these people losing their mind on top of everything else they might want to say about him, right? And then they go so far to the extreme after the first African-American president, putting in another incompetent white dude in there,
mm-hmm.
right? And one who is appealing, basically, to the racist elements of the country.
Okay.
And he was the most extreme element. I mean, you know, they had a whole bunch of examples, a whole bunch of candidates on the primary Republican side. He was the most extreme, willing to say anything. And to have people buying into this, like, that was okay. We're with the guy who's willing to say anything, even about his fellow Republicans, about anybody, willing to be disrespectful, willing to look down on people, willing to encourage violence. And so I can only, at this point in my life, believe that America, you know, that's our business, racism, right?
Mm-hmm.
America's business is racism and keeping a certain segment of the population down. And there's people that certainly believe in what can be considered the evil, as good and evil. So they must be evil because they believe in doing evil things. To me, Emma, you're...
Yeah, you know one thing, I don't know if you've heard, but what's his name? I can't even think to point of one and say his name. Trump has said that Susan Rice has committed a crime and she should be arrested. That's the way
But he never said what the crime was, you know. There was no
he
empirical evidence.
Needs,
he just throws it out there.
Reasons, yeah. Well, he's stepping on dangerous territory right now because he is dealing right now with black women. He doesn't want to do that, okay? Because we will organize black women in this country like you have never seen before.
Right.
So I think President
Trump should be scared.
No, well, I'm telling you.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point that you say that, Ma, because I was thinking the same thing, really, that here they are going after this black woman, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they really have no problems going after women, period, if you look at how viciously they went after Hillary.
Right.
But here they are going after Susan Rice for the second time, because remember the first time they tried to make her the scapegoat around Hillary and Benghazi and things like that. And it's really, you know, after a minute, we're really starting to see that it's getting a little personal, right? It's almost like you're taking it a little personal how they are consistently trying to denigrate the administration and the presidency of Barack Obama, trying to eliminate all of his accomplishments and the things that he tried to do, and try to then blame him for all of the problems that this guy is dealing with that are inherent in the presidency. And that's why I said, that's why to me it feels a little, it's unprecedented in the presidency that the successor would put so much blame on its predecessor. And if there's any blame to be thrown about, certainly the last two Republican presidents, Trump included, there's a lot of blame to be thrown around. But, you know, we're too busy trying to reinvent George Bush's image instead of pointing blame.
I want to take you back to a point in time in 1968, 69, 70, 71. Of course, when Watergate hit, be very aware
It took a year for Watergate to go from the break-in discovery by Frank Willis to the ouster of Richard Milhouse Nixon. Over a year. And when they started with Mr. Willis, they defamed this brother, who was purely a janitor working in the Watergate, and discovered that someone had put tape on the Democratic office and reported it to security. And the articles, because I grew up in Washington, D.C., and I can tell you the articles in which Richard Dean and Nixon's attorney's entourage would place the blame on Mr. Willis, Frank Willis, for doing his job. Deflection. This is nothing
right, exactly.
new. So really, what Trump is and his crew, and it's interesting, note today that Bannon was taken off of the national security team.
Hallelujah.
That's, that in itself is saying he's listening to his generals, because at some point they know there's enough evidence right now. As Congressman Castro said, if he were a betting man, some of these people are going to jail. And now we see the backpedaling.
Yeah.
And what's happening now is that they're literally what we call in the business CYA, covering their ass.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
And they're going to start pointing fingers at each other so that they can deflect the real attention from who really is guilty of treason.
Well, that's why Mike Flynn wants, he wants immunity, right? I mean, what did he say? It's interesting how these guys' words, the tactic of accusing people, the exact thing that they're doing, right? And I think that started because the Republican power role, when people used to bust them doing things, but they would turn around and accuse the Democrats of doing exactly what they were doing. And just put the blame on
that. Exactly.
And if you look at that, Mike Flynn up there encouraging people. Donald Trump got the nerve to start to chant "lock somebody up" when he's getting brought into court for people out of their money for Trump University, amongst many other things. Mike Flynn had the nerve to get up at the Republican convention, leading the chant "lock her up," and then getting out and meet the press and talking about, usually when somebody wants immunity, that means they've done something wrong. Well, he just asked for immunity, talking about he would be willing to testify if he had some kind of immunity. The constant hypocrisy and lying of this whole crew, I mean, this is what concerns me, that clearly, they did have performed in collusion with Russia to affect the outcome of this election. That was part of the intelligence report that he received from Comey that day that he never acted on, that they were under investigation since July. And these people have colluded with Russia to commit treason, and it's only because we don't have that smoking gun that they're able to get away with it. And also the fact that they're able to get away with it, and they're trying to derace, to put, keep saying this every time, derace to cover, like you say, cover their ass, to put people in the key positions to shut down the investigations, to shut down all the people asking the questions. That's why the son-in-law is in there, Jack. He's just head of government operations to see where he can make government run better. He can make it run better than all the people that have been doing it for all these hundreds of years. Here come the rich young white cat who's going to be more brilliant than the experts and everybody else. That ain't nothing but a picture. Picture, everybody close their eyes and picture this with me. That's picture Donald Trump leaning back at the desk in the Oval Office with his daughter on one side and his son-in-law on the other in front of him on the desk and say, "Well, I told you, kids, here we go. What do you want to do? Pick what you want to do." Right? That's what this is. This guy gets in office and he's pointing his son-in-law. It's like one of those old movies. And the son-in-law married up because daddy has a good job to give the son-in-law. the comedy of this stuff is really, it's like you have to laugh at it because it is so sad that this man is an embarrassment completely and stole and committed treason. This is the thing, because these guys, they run around talking about patriotism and America this and that, and Barack Obama was a foreigner. These guys got down with Russia, our arch enemy, that certainly anybody my age and probably even older has been taught that they are our arch enemies, Russia. And here Donald Trump
one
come
of the
along.
Things,
go ahead.
One of the things that's really interesting, and this will bear witness through the testimonies of all that are coming forward, all of the swing states, Eric, Wayne, and Kay, all of the swing states that were supposed to be the states that would determine the election, Trump won them all by 1%. Now, if you're a statistic teacher, a professor at Harvard, do you know he would tell you the potential for that to happen in every one of those swing states is ultimately the percentage of that to happen is almost off the chart as
right.
It can't happen. And the reason why it could happen is because in each and every one of those states, those 1,000 hackers that they have identified that participated in the Russian hacking were working in those swing states. You see, This is where this they're connecting these dots. Because, see, every one of the Republican denials are actually saying the reason why they're standing by that it must be a rigged situation and that it couldn't possibly be happening is because they're saying the Russians would have had to hack the ballot box. They didn't have to hack the ballot box. That's the last place thing you want to hack.
Byron. Okay.
Yes.
Listen, I'm sitting here simmering because of the fact that I'm thinking about Susan. All right?
Susan what?
I'm thinking about, what's her name? I forget her name.
Susan Rice.
Susan Rice. Okay. Susan Rice. Yes. Listen, I'm really getting very, very angry. And somebody should inform Donald Trump that if you call for black women, you know, to save a black woman from any kind of embarrassment again in life, you will see a parade of black women that you will not believe because I will start calling for it myself, every sorority in the country and out of the country. Okay? So,
yes.
Mr. Trump, please be aware of what you're doing. You know, we are not even residents, okay? We are people, you know, in this country, and we are living black African-American women, and you really don't want that kind of problem. Is that a threat?
I agree with
you.
It's just
a suggestion, but it will happen. You know, you cannot do this to the African American community. Next thing you know, is he'll be cutting. He'll be fooling around with our health prop.
Right. That's what he's doing.
And he's doing that. And then no one seems to be stopping him. Is he qualified really to be the president of this United States? People better think about this. Go ahead, Wayne.
No, the only thing I was going to say to that, I mean, until something significant happens, you know, all these little things that he's piecemeal, day by day, there's something new. All of a sudden now they're changing the tax code for those who haven't paid their tax bills to the IRS. All of a sudden, for years, if you had problems with the IRS, they would normally write you. There was a whole scandal the last couple of years where they would people would call up claiming to be agents of the IRS trying to pick up on a collection, and it turned out to be bogus. All of a sudden now, Trump is president, and he's allowing collection agencies to be participants, you know, in calling individuals who are apparently behind in their tax bills and trying to extract money from them that way, which further clouds the confusion about, is this a legitimate process? You talk about the Susan Rice thing. So glad Byron brought up, you know, the history with Watergate, because, you know, it amazes me. I had to jog my memory for a minute. You're right. It took almost 2 years before Tricky Dick was able to get out of the office there and never seen or heard from again after that. But the problem is we still have an issue with Mark Pence. If this is to happen, to me, they have to delegitimize the election just to wipe the slate clean. They may,
well,
maybe this for the first, you know, the first time in this country, they need to just call an election maybe a year or 2 years from now if there's enough going on. Because to me, the vice president is just as guilty as the president.
Right. Well, that's why I've been saying, promoting the notion that things should be pending that he's doing, because he got in there under questionable circumstances. He should not be president. That's why the Senate is trying to, you know, do the whole filibuster about the current Supreme Court nominee, because he shouldn't be nominated. They didn't give Barack Obama, they broke the system, didn't give Obama's nominee an opportunity. And Ma, you're right about the, I was trying to get the mic because I was going to say to you about they're going after to the medical, the affordable health care. I mean, their plan they put out was, you know, more taxes for people, tax breaks for the upper 1% or whatever, and the average person would end up paying more money. I mean, you know, and the fact that these guys have been talking about it for 7 years and how bad it was, and this is what I'm saying, part of their systematic denigrating of Barack, the Obama presidency, seems to be more than just the normal denigrating of one's predecessor, which I've never heard done before in my lifetime that any president has come along. But clearly, you know, you try to figure out what's different about the last president that this guy feels comfortable doing that, and the most obvious comes to mind. But also when you figure it's Donald Trump, too, and he's not the type of guy who respects any type of tradition or protocol or respects anybody, period, you figure that all bets are off. And he should, in the meantime of us trying to find, you guys talk about it a year, 2 years before they were able to get Nixon out of office. In the meantime, they get to, Trump is screwing up the country, you know, he's reversing
exactly.
A lot of this on the environment. Financial decisions, like you just said, also allowing, you know, companies to sell people's browser history. That was another one. All of these things, allowing people to hunt down animals from helicopters and go in the dens and kill these bears. I mean, it's ridiculous. A lot of the things that he's just systematically reversing. He can't do it with any legislation. Because his ratings are so low. That's why his first 100 days, he's not going to have any major pieces of legislation passed. Only thing he's been doing is executive orders. So he really hasn't accomplished much. But in the meantime, he's still messing everything up, in my opinion. You want to say, Mom?
Also, yeah, I want you to think about the incarceration rates, you know, numbers of African-American men being incarcerated. And sometimes for made-up reasons. Okay, so we should start really thinking about these things, because if Trump stays in office, you know, I just feel that a lot of things is going to happen, because this just, that does not make sense. And I know every woman, every African-American woman, or every woman, period, listening to me who has any sense at all, you know, not only the African-American women, not only Latin American women, not only Indian-American women, but every woman should stand up and be counted, okay?
Mm-hmm.
That really just makes me so angry to think of all the people that, even with police brutality and police killing,
right.
Okay? Byron, what is his name? The boy who was shot in Florida?
Trayvon Martin.
We have so many we could name.
Right, and that's a really good point too, because you know it makes me think. It kind of answers the question. There have been a number of black activists who were saying, "What did Obama do for black people?" Tavis Smiley was one of them. Cornel West, you know, people like to get on Obama. And to me, what Obama did was focus on those incarceration issues. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, a lot of things people don't understand. What the president can do, they're like, you know, these little orders and things that Trump is doing that's messing up or rescinding a lot of Obama's work. It's also those were the little things that Barack Obama was doing to help people of color. You know the incarceration rate, the disparity in sentencing between crack cocaine and powder cocaine. Those are, and also the whole felon thing and letting some people out of jail. Those are the things that Obama was working at that directly affects the African American community and the Latino community and communities of color. And these are things that he was accused of not doing to help his people. But not only was he doing that, now that's something that's being reversed by Trump, you know, like you're saying. So the incarceration rates aren't going to get any focus out of this administration. They could care less about the incarceration rates of African-American people. Yeah, they probably would. So all of those kind of social issues are going to go out the window, and certainly issues that affect people of color and people in the lower socioeconomic bracket of the United States, right?
You know, there's a story coming on, not a story, a program coming on television about 9 o'clock, and it's The Messy Truth by, I forget his name, Van Jones. I suggest that everybody watch it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I think we have to get even more, you know, more involved in, you know, black rights, okay? These young students are leading this, you know? Black
well,
women matter.
Well, one
matter. I'm so angry.
One of the things that you... Yeah,
go
ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was going to just say, with respect to the prison industrial complex in this country, notice that
mm-hmm.
Jeff Beauregard Sessions, our attorney general,
mm-hmm.
is rolling back the consent decrees that helped to establish the rehabilitation of our police force and justice systems in places like Ferguson and Baltimore. And when you roll back the those particular enforced Justice Department programs to help restructure a system out of control, now you're going to go back to that place where they are still out of control because there's no consent decree being established by the Justice Department to make sure these out of control police departments are fixed with respect to our African American communities. And there's something
real
that's
quickly,
really dangerous.
Real quickly, what does the consent decree mean? Really quickly, because we're coming up
the,
on 2 minutes.
The consent decree, okay. What that means is that the Justice Department went into Ferguson and Baltimore when two of the most hottest situations with the murder of the young African-American high school senior, and then, of course, with the situation in Baltimore where the police departments were found to be abusing the African-American community. And the consent decree orders were to – and have the Justice Department guide these new programs in those cities like Ferguson, like Baltimore, to make adjustments to their police department. Now, rolling back those consent decrees, that will have major impact
real briefly, Bobby,
on the relationship.
Real briefly, wrap it up. Put a point in it. Put a point.
Yes.
Put a nail in it. Rolling back means what?
Rolling back means that they're trying to undo all the advancements of the Obama administrations with respect to police reform,
prison great.
Reform.
Thanks, everybody.
So
we want to thank everybody. Thanks. All right, great. Thanks, Byron. Thanks for joining us this week.
Yes,
Byron
sir.
Saunders. All right.
Yes,
talk
sir.
To you next week. All right, Wayne Gilman, thanks for joining in on the
K-Town
Live Show. Wayne Gilman. Talk to you again next week. Bye-bye. We want to say thank you, everybody, for listening to the K-Thompson Live Show. You can listen to it live every Wednesday, 8 to 9 p.m. And you can also listen to the archive because the show is available anytime you want. You can go to K Thompson Live on the Blog Talk Radio. Go to blogtalkradio.com/K Thompson Live. I'm the son. My name is Eric Payne, and you are.
I'm the mother of Eric Payne, and my name is K Thompson Payne, but K Thompson Live.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening in. We'll see you again next week. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Mm-hmm.